I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Lorraine Fangel, professor of government at the University of Texas, Austin. We're discussing her 2020 book, Reason and Character, The Moral Foundations of Aristotelian Political Philosophy, from the University of Chicago Press. Fangel works on ancient, early modern, and American political philosophy, with special interests in ethics, the philosophy of education, and problems of justice and moral responsibility. She is the author of 5 books and numerous articles. So first of all, let me say, Lorraine Fangel, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much for having me.
Lorraine, I love the book. It was a really close reading of a classic text, but a text that always rewards revisiting. And you brought out for me, I think, in this book, the elusive way that I think Aristotle understands reason and its relationship to the virtues. So I found that to be very useful. But also, your attention to the dialectical character of the text, the various different kinds of audiences that Aristotle's responding to. So I found it to be a really rich discussion of this text. So thank you for the book. Let me start by asking just what the motivation was for you writing this book in the first place.
Oh, okay. Well, yes, thanks for your kind comments. The Nicomachean Ethics, I think, has always been, well, for a long time, has been my favorite book. Since I was a freshman in college, I was just charmed and delighted with the promise that it holds out, that if you think carefully and deeply about your life and about happiness, and you live intelligently and deliberately, you can have a very fulfilling life, that philosophy can be practical and beneficial to us in that way. And the particular question that drove the writing of this book was the Socratic question, the Socratic claim that virtue is knowledge. And behind that, for me, is a very, very old interest in the problem of moral responsibility. In what way are we truly responsible for our choices? Does it make sense to reward and punish people on the basis of what they choose, or are we all just enmeshed in an endless web of causes and effects, so that ultimately everything that we do and choose was necessitated? And I originally had in mind to write one book. In fact, this book was, I had originally thought, would be part of my PhD dissertation, which would be on Aristotle on choice and how choice happens, and especially on the question of how we choose our own good versus other people's good, so looking at friendship. So that turned out to be 3 books. My dissertation was on Aristotle on friendship, books 8 and 9 of the Ethics primarily. Then there was going to be an original first chapter that would look at the Socratic paradoxes that Aristotle, I think, responds to in several Socratic dialogues, Platonic dialogues, and that turned into a book of its own, the Virtue is Knowledge book on the foundations of Socratic political thought. And then finally, I got back around to this, so I'm finally finishing my PhD dissertation.
Well, you're a good example of when we tell PhD students their dissertation prospectus is like 3 books.
Yes.
You just point to Lorraine Fangel. That's good.
It's been a great journey.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. I think it'd be helpful to sort of lay out some of those, sort of the background context for it a little bit more, because I think it plays an important role. I mean, in your discussion of the ethics, in the discussion of the nature of the good life, the foil really here is Plato's Socrates and, the claim that virtue is knowledge, as you mentioned. Maybe you could say a little bit about kind of how you conceive of the Platonic or Socratic alternative to Aristotle's view. I realize that this means essentially summarizing your previous book, but I think it would be helpful to at least get a, get 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 the contrast so that we can, you know, then go on to talk about how Aristotle both is similar to and different than Plato on this.
Yeah. And so one of the big questions here is there a big difference? How big is the difference between Plato and Aristotle on this? And at least rhetorically, there's a huge difference. So we've got these Socratic paradoxes. Virtue is knowledge. Everyone who knows what's good does what's good. Vice is ignorance. The proper response then to vice is education, not retributive punishment. And Socrates in Plato presents these paradoxical thoughts in a very stark way. You know, he says in the Gorgias, for example, that the tyrant doesn't do anything of what he wants to do. So his vice is all involuntary. What he wants is to be happy, and he's not succeeding in being happy. And I think in Plato, these things are thrown at us to provoke thought, and they can provoke very rich thought, but there are a lot of steps. Aristotle is coming in and he's saying, you know, you've jumped over a lot of steps that are really important. You're not putting enough emphasis on the importance of character. You're leaving the impression that everybody is somehow the same in all just pursuing the good as we see it, and not emphasizing the fact that good people's ends are different. Even if the thing that we all most deeply want is happiness, and happiness turns out to be more similar, what would be make us all happy turns out to be more similar than we might think, still the ends that we're pursuing are different, and that's really important. Aristotle insists that there's an important difference between voluntary and involuntary action in how much it shows. And therefore, there are ways that we can and should be holding ourselves and each other responsible that Socratic thought might make it harder for us to see, the Socratic presentation of that. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it occurs to me, I mean, there are a couple different things in terms of contrast that you mentioned in the book and you mentioned it here. I mean, one is this sort of, as you say, sort of heterogeneity of the good in Aristotle versus, you know, homogeneous character of the good in Plato. I mean, another I think contrast that you draw in the book, which maybe you could say a little bit about here, is you could just say the political, you know, the consequentialist, as it were, benefits of attending to, you know, moral responsibility. That, you know, if you just think that we're not really truly responsible for our actions and vice is just a matter of ignorance, that's probably not a good way to found a political society, right? It's better to hold people responsible for their actions. And so in some ways, Aristotle's view is, you know, it's a kind of education, not just of aspiring philosophers, but a foundation for a sound political order, right?
Yes, very much so. And so that would be a big difference between him and most of the Platonic dialogues. I mean, you know, take the Republic in particular. It's got the purpose of sketching what a perfectly just regime would be in such a way as to make us, to detach us from the real regimes that we live in, and to make us see that perfect happiness would exist in a philosophic life, to dampen political ambitions, I think. In the Laws, Plato becomes much more practical. So part of there's a kind of dialectical whirlpool that Plato engages in, and these paradoxes that I talked about are part of that, where he wants to raise radical questions and fire the enthusiasm of promising students for philosophy. So, you know, that's part of the divine madness, you see. This fantastic picture of the contemplation of the good in the Republic and in the Symposium and in the Phaedrus. And Aristotle is bringing things back down to earth, and he's kind of putting front and center the stable, mature gentleman and his concerns, and saying, in effect, to young students, you know what? You need to sit down and listen more to these people. You need to listen to them for a long time. And there's a great deal that society needs to learn in its education from these people, but even and especially philosophic students themselves, he suggests. You know, he makes this amazing statement that the young are not good students of political philosophy because they don't have enough experience. And he says this in the Lyceum, where his main students are the young. But the serious thought here seems to be we need to slow down and listen to the voice of respectable opinion, even in understanding human nature philosophically.
Right.
Yeah. Say there's also just a very big practical project that I think complements the Socratic and Platonic project of benefiting society and giving more concrete, sober advice.
Yeah, I mean, these would be, you know, deferring to the very people that Socrates taught us we should investigate and question. And I thought maybe you could say a little bit about so this gentlemanly class, is that it's spoudaios? Is that the Greek term? Memory serves. So, I've always been sort of puzzled as to who these individuals actually are. Is that just sort of the elite in any regime, or does it particularly refer to, you know, or like an aristocratic class or sort of educated class? Could it be oligarchs, or does he not involve that? Maybe, you know, a sketch of, you know, who the spoudaios are.
Mm-hmm. Another good word to bring in is the gentleman, the kalos kagathos, the person who has a certain independent spirit and who takes the noble very seriously, who is morally serious, and who in either an aristocracy or a mixed regime would be setting the tone. And I think we've got an expansive concept here. So this kind of gentleman is front and center, but what he's also eliciting is ordinary moral opinion of all of us, as much in contemporary America as in ancient Greece. That aspect of us, that set of concerns that we have, concerns with living well, with dignity, with freedom, the belief that a good life is not a life in which we're simply jerked around by pleasures and pains and fears, but we chart our own course. And we have a good sense of rank, of what's high and what's low. So he's speaking to serious moral opinion everywhere and always. And the Greek gentleman would be kind of exhibit A. But rather than codifying his outlook, Aristotle is also correcting it. There are new virtues he brings in that don't have names. And there are virtues or quasi-virtues that he talks about, but then he ends up taking them out of his catalog of virtues. Both shame and eidos, or reverence and moral indignation, fall into that category. And they get demoted. So he's taking the kind of common moral intuitions of serious people everywhere and trying to refine and educate them.
Yeah, that's good. I mean, presumably there are certain kinds of, social and political preconditions for the existence of such a class, right? I mean, there's presumably Aristotle would see there are certain societies in which, you know, either that class doesn't exist or they're thoroughly vicious, right? So this is, you know, I'm just trying to, methodologically, I mean, that might be helpful to sort of turn to that, you know, thinking about Aristotle's method here. I mean, he begins with common received opinion, but he doesn't just stop there. So I'm sort of wondering with the process of understanding, you know, the nature of this you know, the Kalos Kagathos or the Spudaios, what sort of how he understands this as a category of person in political terms. Is it a, you know, does it have these political preconditions? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I guess I want to keep pushing on the thought that what he's addressing is quite universal. So the gentleman or the Spudaios, as you're talking about, is a certain type, but what characterizes that type is that they put at the center of their life something that all human beings as human beings have an inkling of and see the importance of to some real extent. So when he goes through the virtues one at a time, I think it's significant that he puts courage first. Generally, manliness, Andrea, and it is first. He doesn't say why it's first, but clearly, you know, a simple tribe honors it very highly because it's so necessary and because it's so impressive, and he brings those things out. Moderation comes next, and moderation is something that we all see the need for, we all see the importance of. So there's a difference of emphasis, but there's not a sharp class difference that would result in some people caring about these things and others not. That's not at all what he's depicting for us.
Mm-hmm. I thought just here at the beginning you could say a little bit about sort of where your book sits vis-a-vis the scholarship, because you say in this in the introduction there are a couple sort of enduring puzzles about the ethics. One of them that I thought you could speak to is the, I'm not sure how you put it, I guess the rational or, you know, the basis of the claims to virtue, the ground of virtue, that it seems that, you know, some scholars argue that, you know, conventional virtue or sort of, you know, baseless, that it's a kind of necessary but baseless feature of political life, where another group of scholars claims that this sort of conventional virtue does possess some rationality in the idea of the noble, and it has some autonomy or self-sufficiency. Maybe you could speak to that and you know, other puzzles that you see in the scholarship that you're speaking to.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, so there's that question of whether he's just codifying the moral opinion of a particular time and place. And I think one of the strongest indications that he's not doing that is that he recognizes the conventionalist view. He talks about how much our understanding of virtue and vice does differ to the point where some people think it's all conventionalist, and he rejects that. Another big difference among scholars of Aristotle, I mean, one thing that almost all of them have in common is they're trying to get what is his teaching, what is his line, what is the doctrine here? They're trying to make it all fit together. And what's unusual about my approach is that I think Aristotle is having multiple conversations at once. He's trying out multiple ideas at once and showing us the strengths and the weaknesses of them. And he's weaving together a book that's both very practical and very theoretical at the same time with a diverse audience, so that it's full of puzzles. And one of the disagreements that has run through a lot of the literature is, what's his view of happiness? Does he ultimately have, as some of them put it, a very broadly inclusive view of happiness, including all kinds of goods, of love and friendship and wealth and pleasure and political activity and philosophy? Or does he have a narrower view of happiness as just the activity of virtue? Or the most narrow would be just the activity of intellectual virtue, namely philosophy. So that we've got this inclusive or dominant or exclusive understanding of happiness. I think they're all at play in that. And we can talk more about its complex development of the idea of happiness. But another one is the dispute between people who think that ultimately, Aristotle's teaching is that virtue gets its guidance from reason, the intellectualists, versus the non-intellectualists who say that virtue, that intellectual excellence or phronesis gets its guidance from virtue, and that it's the well-habituated passions that are really the guidance for it. And on this dispute also, I think there isn't a simply clear, consistent teaching one way or the other. But instead, he's unpacking puzzles in our experience, our lived experience of the moral life, that require that we do a lot of sorting and think for a long time about what it is about our views that are tangled and why we're so attached to those tangled views.
I wanted to turn to happiness in the discussing the first book, but it was hoping to ask you first, before we get into that, sort of your understanding of how, of the sort of oft-remarked feature of the ethics, that it has sort of abstracts from piety. This is sort of one of the very, you know, anti-conventionalist features of Aristotle's text. Mm-hmm. So presumably if he's as pragmatic as you suggest, he would have room for religion and piety. But aside, you have the discussion about magnificence a little bit later, where it seems to be, you know, to allow at least a little bit of room, but it's sort of surprising that he doesn't. So what's your sense of why it is that he's abstracting in this way?
Yes, it is really surprising that he doesn't. And I think he's written a book that, I mean, you know, his greatest commentator in a way is Thomas Aquinas, who felt that he agreed with almost everything in the Ethics, but thought you had to go a little bit further. So he's done a wonderful job of capturing the moral side of a pious person's concerns. And yet, as you say, he's strikingly silent on the religious beliefs. So he's foregrounding part of the pious person's outlook, which is to think the most important thing is living virtuously. Here's what it looks like. I think he's trying to bolster an independent spirit that can work well for somebody who's a believer or for somebody who's not a believer. And interestingly, I think maybe what Aristotle is especially trying to encourage is an in-between view of someone who's not an atheist, but whose main focus is not on piety, and therefore who's not going to be prone to any kind of religious extremism or religious intolerance, but who doesn't rule out the possibility and may be inclined to hope that there are gods, or there's a God out there that supports good people and the best we can do. If there is such a God, the best we can do is to just live the best life that we can. So there's an interesting discussion of the possibility of the afterlife in Book One, where he pours a lot of cold water on the idea that we live on after we die. He never says that we need to have a realm of rewards and punishments in order for virtue to make sense, to be worthwhile, all to the contrary. But he says it would be too unfeeling to say that what happens after we die doesn't get through to us, doesn't make any difference to us. This is in the interesting chapter where he takes up the claim of Solon that you have to look to the end. You have to wait until somebody dies to be able to say whether their life was happy or not happy. And so there's a lot of rich ambiguity in that. And part of the suggestion, I think, is our concerns necessarily reach beyond our lifetime if we're good people. We care about what happens afterwards. We aren't only concerned with our own action and our own, what we ourselves experience. So he says, yes, in some way, what happens after we die is part of our happiness or unhappiness, but not such a big part as to make a happy life unhappy, or the reverse.
Yeah, it's interesting that the idea of a sort of you know, ecumenical Aristotelian, or, you know, middle of the road Aristotelian with regard to religion. I mean, one of the other thoughts that I had about this, and I just see what you think, because when reading about your discussion, this also helps, I think, you know, raise this the idea of the noble, which you discuss at length in the book too. The idea of the noble is interesting because it, in some ways, has some of the features of the divine in it, in the sense that the noble, the activity, noble activity involves at its highest level a kind of self-sufficiency, right? You do the virtuous thing because it's virtuous. You don't do it because of, you know, some kind of external reward, that it's just kind of beautiful in itself. And that, you know, it shares the self-sufficiency with the divine, and it may also help you live on after your death in the sense of a being, you know, honored. And so, you know, I mean, one way, I guess, to think about, you know, Aristotle, he's trying to replace the pious with the noble, I guess. I mean, it's so kind of more radical, you know, more radical humanistic understanding of Aristotle. Is that too extreme a way of looking at Aristotle, or what do you think about that suggestion?
Yeah, I mean, interesting. If it is, it's not by very much. He's certainly trying to pull out the concern with the noble that's always there in piety and bring it front and center and put the focus on that without saying one way or the other what he thinks about the pious. He leaves that to us, but he's definitely changing our focus if we're following him. And so the noble has, as you say, this interesting character of being, it's a concern with what's high, it's a concern with dignity, it's the concern with doing the right thing just for itself. At the heart of morality, Kant also seizes on this idea as being central. You don't do the most important, highest, most moral things for the sake of anything that you're hoping to get out of them. That makes them not moral. You just do it because it's right. And going along with this, and going back to your question about the spoudaios, is the thought, and the center of our life should be those things that we do just for themselves. Praxis. So it's not earning a living, but it's being in action in noble ways, especially within the political community, especially as a leader, military leader, or political leader, or benefactor. That those are the things that should be the focus of life to the extent that we're able to meet the basic needs. And there's a wonderful sense of freedom that goes with that. And as he goes through the different moral virtues, it's interesting how much freedom from seems to define the virtues. Freedom from any kind of instrumental or utilitarian calculus. So with courage, you aren't controlled by the fear of death. You rise above that somehow. With generosity, you aren't controlled by greed, but you freely give it away. With moderation, you aren't controlled by pleasure and pain. And so there's great dignity in that, and there's great independence in being able to say, my focus is just on acting well for its own sake, so that what other people do, what they give you or don't give you, becomes less important. And in this way, Aristotle is cultivating a free, dignified spirit that's good for aristocracy. It's also good for democracy. And in the chapter that I mentioned before on whether we have to look to the end of somebody's life to determine whether they were happy or not, Aristotle has this nice comparison. He says the noble person focuses on doing the best with whatever he's given. So the best general can fight as well as possible with whatever army he has, just like the best shoemaker can make the best shoes out of the leather that he's given. And that gives a kind of independence. This is I think, quite a powerful recipe for living a good life is to find whatever you need to do, whatever seems worth doing, and focusing on doing it as well as possible without being overly concerned with success or failure, which is not entirely under your control. The problem that in 100 different ways Aristotle brings out, if you think that the goal of life is living nobly, and being noble is doing it just for itself, what is the standard? What is the standard of the excellence that we're after here? And again, it's as if the noble outlook slips away from answering that question of what the standard or the target is. And this is a problem for reason. Moral virtue wants to look to reason, wants to act in accord with reason, but to the extent that we focus on reason, reason seems to be good thinking about a goal that's given. So what's the goal? It can't be anything extrinsic to virtue. It can't be that you're just fighting the whole war and exercising all this courage just for the sake of security. That puts the virtue, the high thing, as just a tool for the sake of a lower thing. But if we don't let ourselves be pinned down on the goal, then we end up with a hazy view of what the standard really is. And I think one of the things that Aristotle is eliciting here is the resistance of the gentlemanly outlook to being pinned down. And he's gently pointing out to us, we need to think about that. We're going to keep shifting around and not be consistent and not really know ourselves if we don't get clear on what our ends and our priorities are.
Yeah, and is reason unable to, you know, apprehend the noble, because there are just lots of different ways in which you can be noble. As you say, you can be a, you know, great, excellent shoemaker or an excellent marksman, or you can be a great murderer, I guess. I mean, the abstraction from the moral too, in a certain way, because you can be excellent at all sorts of vile things. Is that the issue? I mean, because I guess this is a good pivot into book one, because in the discussion of his, you know, the mean sort of three opinions about the best life, pleasure, or political life, or the contemplative life, presumably those three are, you know, regarded as best because they, you know, are, you know, they're the end for which all other things are means for, right? There's a, you know, the political life is the sort of the comprehensive or encompassing view that directs all other lives underneath it, you know, and the pleasure seems to be the kind of the aim of all the things that we're aiming at, right? So, I mean, I guess I'm just wondering, sort of, at some of these places, at least Aristotle is trying to come up with a way to, even if there are some, you know, diverse opinions, to come up with some general categories that we can subsume them under.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So part of the problem, as you say, with specifying what the goal of moral virtue is, what the end is, and therefore what the standard is that reason should be looking to, is that the end comes to sight as very diverse. And in particular, we've got our own good, but we've also got the good of others that we care about. We've got the good of the political community as a whole. What's for the sake of what there is almost something that moral virtue as such doesn't want to have to answer. If you think of either of them, any of those, as being simply the goal and the others being subordinate to it, we end up with an unsatisfactory picture. So are we just the tools of our society, and is our end to be like good worker bees in a hive and make it prosper? That's not satisfactory. But is the society just there to serve us? That doesn't seem noble either. And we want to say both, and we don't really want to settle the question of how they relate to each other. And then there's another set of paradoxes about the end in terms of what is the character of moral virtue. Is it a matter of fulfillment and living the richest, happiest life we can? Is it a matter of giving up our good in a noble way? And again, on the battlefield or in the statesman who gives up his private happiness to take care of the city, you see a picture of that. Or is it something that is not either for our happiness or for something beyond us, but just for itself? Moral opinion wants to say, yes, all of the above, but all of the above isn't ultimately a clear standard.
Yeah, I think one of the really helpful ways for me that you put this in terms of book one is the Aristotle's discussions about happiness and what the good involves. And one way that he discusses it in book one is in terms of self-sufficiency, a kind of almost divine self-sufficiency. But another way that he discusses it, and it doesn't quite go together, and I hadn't really put this together in a way until I read your chapter here, but with the famous function argument, where Aristotle talks about the good and as being connected with a certain telos of our species. And if our telos is connected with our species, then it's not precisely divine or self-sufficient in that way. So there seems to be a tension that these are both, as you say, kind of features that we may point to about the good, but they don't quite go together, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and even in this idea of completeness, so in trying to understand happiness, he says, so happiness is the goal. What is it? And as you say, it seems to have these parts, seems to have something to do with pleasure, something to do with honor, something to do perhaps with contemplation, and a great deal to do with virtue and the exercise of virtue, which is clearly higher than mere pleasure or honor, which seems to be something derivative. So he's focusing in on virtue and on activity, and he asks, okay, we want to find the most complete and perfect activity, the most end-like, the most teleototas, has the most of the character of the telos to it. And he has three different tests of that, each of which points in a somewhat different direction. So is it the most complete, in which nothing is left out? And we do seem to think of happiness as being very complete, but it isn't possible to reach a happiness in which we have as much as possible of every possible good. We've got a limited lifespan, a limited amount of energy. Is it the most final or end-like or ultimate? Is that what he means by the most telos-like, the most pure? That would point in the direction of something especially high, perhaps like contemplation. But then he also speaks about self-sufficiency, and self-sufficiency has a couple of possible meanings to it. In one way, we think of happiness as being self-sufficient in the sense that nobody can hurt us and we don't need anything from anybody else. We've got within ourselves the resources to be completely happy independently, but we're human beings. We care about other human beings. And so self-sufficiency also, as he says, isn't just for me alone, but for friends and family and city, being capable of providing for all the people that we care about. And so he's evoking, I think, very complex hopes that we have and showing us that our yearnings for happiness point in somewhat different directions and leaving us with this as something we just need to think more deeply about. And I think where that really points us is towards deep reflection and self-reflection about what we most truly want. Where you might think all of this discussion of happiness would lead then would be into a deeper investigation of human nature. Okay, so what are the real human needs? What are the real human satisfactions? How do they weigh against each other? How do they compare against each other in terms of the real value that they have? What were we made to take satisfaction in? And instead of going there, he turns to this function argument. And he says, well, maybe we can get hold of what the real end is by thinking about what the function of a human being is. Responding, I think, to the thought of the bewildered reader, you know, what is the end of everything? Well, don't we have an end that's given to us? And so he makes the turn, we've got to think about what's unique about human beings. We're unique in having reason. So happiness seems to be some kind of activity of reason. Okay, so far we're certainly thinking about human nature in comparison to other living beings, for example. Then he says it's an activity of the soul in accord with reason. And then he takes this step. Since a work is seen best when it's done well or excellently, it's an activity of soul in accord with excellence or virtue. And then the whole investigation comes to be about what virtue is. In other words, it's about what does it look like to do whatever you're doing well, rather than focusing on what is it that's most worth doing. And it's at that point that reason begins to take a back seat. So we're focusing not on an activity of reason, but an activity of virtue. And now we have an interrogation of what virtue is, which has the following problem, that we're trying to understand doing well without trying to understand first the what and the goal and the need that we're trying to meet and trying to satisfy. And that leaves the investigation of virtue in a certain way undefined, in a certain way floating. So instead of figuring out what the end is and working back from that, we have a kind of phenomenological, let's just look at virtue. Let's just look at what serious people are serious about. And I think
right.
He thinks that's the way to get at human nature. We've got to just look long and hard at the things that we care most about when we are at our most serious.
Right. It almost seems like, you know, it's a sort of preliminary investigation, I think, as you say in the epilogue, you know, it's a way he's making a start here. And this is the way it plays to start with this, you know, kind of phenomenological exercise, but without coming to any kind of completion. Mm-hmm. I was curious, but as you were speaking, you know, a couple points in the ethics, he has discussions about the different parts of the soul, which you discuss in the book, you know, book six and here in book one. Are we meant to think of the parts of the soul, you know, his discussion of the parts of the soul in this context as a, you know, investigation into human nature? And if so, I mean, it seems strange, right? Because his account of different parts of the soul changes over the course. So is it, you know, is he sort of, you know, changing his account of the soul based on the, you know, different phenomenological discoveries he has? You know, he's kind of working backwards to the account of human nature based on what the phenomena tells us, rather than kind of starting with human nature and then having that, deriving from that certain kinds of conclusions.
Yeah. It's a puzzling business. And so what are the phenomena that we're investigating? There are especially moral opinions. And so the book can have the frustrating, give the frustrating appearance of simply articulating the opinions and not taking the step that we want him to take of getting all the way down to bedrock human nature, analyzing human nature as a philosopher. I think it's not just preliminary. I think that understanding of human nature comes through reflecting on what he's showing us about the opinions. and their tangles. And so one of the tangles that he throws us into, with the warning, this may not be adequate for a really comprehensive understanding, but it's good enough for practice. The soul has parts. And this view of the soul as having parts is part of our moral experience and our moral opinion. Okay, so we think, when we have these lapses, when we think we know what's the best thing to do and we don't do it, there's intellect, which sees what's good, and then there's something else in us, our passions, somehow our lower self, that doesn't properly follow reason. So it's part of the noble outlook that we embrace the idea that passions should take their guidance from reason. And again, to go back to the Republic, you know, there's a picture of the soul there. Reason is supposed to be in charge, and spiritedness is supposed to be its ally, governing the passions, which are doing what reason says is best. So in that picture of the parts of the soul, there's pure theoretical reason. There's the lowest part, which is nutrition and growth that all living things have. There's another non-rational part that involves the passions, or maybe that's the lower of the rational parts. It's the seat of moral virtue, and it's very unclear whether it's non-rational or somehow rational in the sense of being able to listen to reason, or maybe phronesis, active wisdom, is in fact part of that in-between part. That's unclear. And I think he's capturing an unclarity in ordinary opinion about where moral virtue lies, whether it gives guidance to reason, which is instrumental, or whether reason lays down the law to it, and somehow moral opinion wants to think both of those. Now, the alternate view of the soul, which he indicates might be better, is that reason and passion don't belong to separate parts of the soul. The soul doesn't really have separate parts. It has different activities. It has different functions. And judgment about what's good and passion in attraction or aversion to what's good are two parts of the same thing, like the convex and the concave of a single arc. They're not separate things. That view of the soul goes with the view, the Socratic view, that clearly and truly to see the good is to desire the good. And we don't, in fact, have reason pointing us in one direction and passion pointing us in another direction. But if that's the case, then what we have grown up to think of as moral responsibility, what we've grown up to think of as the common phenomenon of knowing what's good and not doing it, those are our misunderstandings. So he's pointing us towards the Socratic thought that judgment and passion are really united, but only in a pointing us there in an indirect way.
Yeah, and this comes up again in when you talk about the third book on the voluntary and the involuntary, and I thought we could turn to that because this is, you know, maybe the most, or say one of the most direct ways in which Aristotle seems to be responding to Plato, Socrates in the discussion of, you know, whether we can act knowingly and voluntarily, you know, in a vicious way. And, you know, so it seems that, I mean, one of the useful things about your chapter is you sort of sketch out the ways in which Aristotle, you know, similar to Plato, Socrates in some way, moves in that direction, or is at least tempted by that, but also carves out a genuine way in which, you know, the voluntary and the involuntary can be distinct, that these are distinct categories, that it need not just simply be reducible to knowledge. Maybe you could say a little bit about that.
Yeah, good. And I am inclined to think that he's not just tempted by the Socratic insights, but he's ultimately persuaded by them. But he thinks that they need to be couched in more context that will be more politically and socially and individually constructive, if you will. So one of the things that he thinks Plato doesn't stress enough is the way we can and do shape our own characters through what we do, through the choices we make. And another is that virtue is a matter of the whole character, not just intellectual insight, but it's a joining of insight and having the right desires and having the right habits. And all three of those things are important. And another thing is that there are ways in which we can and should hold each other responsible and hold ourselves responsible, which I think Socrates actually agrees with and Plato actually agrees with, but downplays to some extent. So on the voluntary and the involuntary, it may be true. I think they all three think it is true that the person who's vicious ultimately is not living the life that he really wishes for, because viciousness doesn't produce happiness. Nevertheless, he's doing voluntary things that are forming his life and shaping his character, and it makes a huge difference whether somebody is acting voluntarily or not. It makes a big difference whether you accidentally poison somebody, for example, or you deliberately poisoned them. It makes a big difference in how we should treat one another, in how we should assess one another, in how we should assess ourselves. So that Aristotle gives a narrow definition of the voluntary as the thing taken narrowly, a thing that you really intended to do, you intended the immediate outcome, regardless of whether you knew where it was ultimately leading or not. And in this section on moral responsibility in Book 3, one of the interesting features of this discussion, which goes very deep, is that Aristotle keeps taking the line, we are responsible for our choices, we are responsible for our character, and keeps allowing himself to be interrupted with somebody who's raising objections that sound rather Socratic. One of them is, well, don't pleasure and the noble things compel us just as much as painful things can compel us? Because Aristotle has conceded, sometimes terrible pressures can overwhelm people and cause them to do things that aren't good. To that, Aristotle has the interesting response, compulsion is one thing, and that's different from doing what you wanted to do. Even though I think he is acknowledging the power of the thought, there's a kind of necessity at work in everything we do, but it's not the same thing, either to be forced by terrible circumstances or by some addiction or other weakness to do something that you really didn't want to do. The objector asks, well, don't anger and desire make acts involuntary? A similar kind of objection. And Aristotle concedes that there is ultimately something involuntary in being vicious, in the sense if your character has degenerated, you're not going to be happy with the result. He also concedes that vice involves not seeing clearly what the right ends are. And that's a big concession to Plato and to Socrates. The final objection is, do we choose how things seem to us? Yes, we choose what to do on the basis of what seems best to us. But does anybody really choose how clearly they see what's good? And to that, Aristotle does not respond with a counter argument. He essentially just spells out the thought. It may be that the most important thing for each of us is how clearly we see what's good. That's all important. And I think he's indicating at the end of the day, that's true.
Right. So is it fair to summarize that? I mean, Aristotle and Socrates are in agreement that no one does vice knowingly. But the purpose here is not to punish, but to educate. But education, in Aristotle's view, is going to take account more comprehensively of the person. It's not just going to educate cognitive features of art, but it's going to involve a lot of complexities about the different ways in which we can go wrong, and the different both effective and cognitive ways in which we can go wrong, and how we can be educated the right. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah. And Aristotle keeps stressing the importance of habit and habituation. Therefore, the importance of childhood education, moral education, and habituation. Once you have somebody who's grown up, who's a criminal, you can't really straighten out their soul very well again. Sometimes you can. And if you see clearly the problems with retributive punishment, which Plato brings out so clearly, then the consequence is we have a responsibility to one another to be much more serious about education from the start, and to follow more clearly the insight on how important habituation is and how important models and encouraging the admiration for the right models is. And this is something that in our society we have gotten away from and I think need to pay more attention to again.
Yeah, hear, hear. Well, I mean, the next discussion in the ethics is about virtues. So, I mean, that's about the different virtues. So that's it's an interesting transition as a way. I mean, I haven't quite thought about the transition exactly from the discussion of the voluntary and the involuntary to the virtues, but maybe that's the ticket there. I thought we just could hit a few of the virtues so far as we haven't have any time left here, but your discussion of courage is really rich and interesting. I mean, courage is one of, it's the first virtue. It's an important virtue. It's the longest discussion, right? In Aristotle, the virtues.
Well, justice is the longest.
Okay. Right. Okay. So, but in courage, right, there's the discussion of justice, courage in the true sense versus in just its apparent sense. So I saw this one quote in your book. You say Aristotle's entire treatment of courage may be said to be an experiment in resolutely resisting the Socratic reduction of courage to knowledge or wisdom. You can say a little bit about that, how Aristotle sort of responding to this, sort of maybe overly cognitive approach to courage in Plato, and how he sort of reformulates his view.
Yeah, good. And so the place where he perhaps develops that very cognitive view of virtue most clearly is at the end of the Protagoras, where Socrates is saying to Protagoras, doesn't everybody do what they think is best? Doesn't everybody go towards the things that they think are good and avoid the things that are bad? Doesn't that have the consequence that the courageous who look like they're willingly advancing towards what's most bad and most terrible really are just making some kind of calculation, just like the cowards, and doing what seems best to them? And Protagoras, of course, can't stand that because it seems to bring the courageous down to the level of the cowards. So Aristotle is giving their due to the brave soldiers who fight well and who have different ends and a different character from the cowards. He's focusing on battlefield courage because that seems especially noble. It's especially voluntary. It's more impressive than bearing up well under a misfortune that you can't do anything about. And it shows the importance of voluntary choice in virtue at its best and its highest. And the test that that courage has to pass here, if, as Aristotle is saying, the activity of moral virtue is the substance of happiness, how can this activity meet that test when it's so difficult and so painful, and when the results are often so disastrous for the brave man himself? So the thought that's being explored is the end is simply different. The end is just the noble for its own sake. And that's not even commensurate with the other things that cowards and ordinary people are more concerned with.
That's a nice way to sort of head towards the greatness of soul discussion, because I mean, the greatness of soul discussion is one of the most famous discussions and most commented on in the ethics. Your discussion of it, I think, is distinctive in bringing out the way in which it's an ascent, but also one that reveals the kind of internal tensions with the category of the noble that we've been discussing, mm-hmm. right? That that greatness of soul, in some ways, is, you know, its unconcernedness with honors of lesser people, and its aspiration to self-sufficiency as a feature of the noble leads to a kind of way in which it's the magnificent, or the great soul is separated from the political community. The political community itself requires commitment to justice and being part of a general whole. So there seems to be some tension even between, you know, this aspiration to self-sufficiency and being part of a political community at all, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are a lot of tensions there. And maybe I could start by tying it back again to courage, because there's the same problem in both of them. They're both very impressive. And in their being so impressive and so noble, they're both trying to hold true to this idea that the excellence is just an end in itself, which I think is kind of against the pragmatism of Socrates. And the problem that the courageous man has is that he thinks that this nobility is the thing, it's so great that it's the thing that makes everything that he sacrifices worth giving up. And yet the nobility in itself, if this noble act is not for the sake of the community, or for the sake of his own property or his own survival, then it turns out that it's precisely the giving up your good that's so noble. That's the thing that makes it so noble, and its nobility is what makes it so good. And so it comes to be the giving up the good that's the supremely good thing, which doesn't really make sense. That points us back to the thought that real courage certainly is a virtue, but it maybe isn't quite so high. It, as he says in Book 10, it after all isn't an end in itself. Nobody fights wars just for the sake of fighting wars unless they're bloodthirsty. We do them for some purpose. So that real courage would be steadfastness, not losing your head when you've decided that something is worth risking for a reason. And that's where the citizen soldier who's fighting for his country comes out of it, I think, looking much better than he did at first. Yes, he's very much concerned with honor and with pragmatic results, but that makes him more sober. So the man of greatness of soul has a similar problem in that he wants his own activity to be so high and so independent. He wants not to need the city, and yet he needs something to do. He needs a focus for his activity if he's not going to live in idleness, which isn't very satisfying. But he can't simply make himself the servant of the city if he's going to be clear about the fact that noble activity is higher than any function that it serves. And so he ends up being stuck. And I think this is not a problem just for him, but a problem with this whole idea of the noble that started back in book one, the doing it well for its own sake. Unless we get clear on what we're trying to accomplish and why it's valuable, we're going to be confused. And the noble and the moral resist this, the kind of necessary analysis. Aristotle talks about nobility as acting, the noble or the beautiful, the kalon, as just for itself. And there's a rich discussion of it in the chapter on magnificence, which is the high version of generosity, building a temple, endowing a worship or a tragic chorus. And there he focuses on, okay, what is beautiful? Well, what's beautiful is what's suitable to its object. We can't break free of the object and just soar off into devotion to the beautiful itself. And that's the problem of the man of greatness of soul who wants to simply be an end and wants his activity to simply be an end. So if we were to see that problem and come back down to earth, there are two very important and eligible directions to go in. One is to say, living among other human beings and benefiting them and benefiting yourself and meeting needs, that's worthwhile, and doing it well is very satisfying. And we get a certain independence from focusing on just doing it well, but we can't kid ourselves into thinking that this is just activity for its own sake. The other direction is philosophy. And philosophy, I think, does turn out to be the human activity that, of all serious activities, is mostly for itself. But it's also for figuring out what we need as needy, limited human beings.
Right, and of course, in one of Aristotle's examples of great, great souled person is Socrates, right? I mean, also mentions who, Ajax and Achilles? I'm trying to remember from
the... Yeah, in the posterior analytics.
Yeah, the posterior analytics.
There are two forms of greatness of soul. One is intolerance of dishonor, like Achilles and Ajax, and the other is independence of fortune, like Socrates. And the man of greatness of soul in the Ethics is kind of an amalgam of the two. He does care about honor, but he's not completely clear on how much he cares about honor. He deserves the greatest honor, and that characterizes him, but he also doesn't let himself need it from other people. He's fairly independent of fortune, but not entirely so.
Yeah. I get one of the reasons I'm often confused by this discussion is I wonder why the legislator, the lawgiver, is not an example of the great-souled person. Now, you have a discussion of the lawgiver a little bit later with the discussion of active wisdom or phrenesis in the ways in which, you know, that activity of a lawgiver is both, you know, commitment to something enduring, but also to something that's changeable. But, you know, I wonder if it's not the kind of same thing here, that the great-souled person, you know, can achieve a kind of self-sufficiency in giving rise to a community that's going to be enduring. That's, you know, he doesn't get anything back, he or she doesn't get anything back in return, but creates instead a self-sufficient political community that reflects the self-sufficiency that the great soul person has.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder why, you know, why isn't that an example in Aristotle? In other words, I'm often confused by that.
Yeah. It's interesting that he doesn't give us more examples. And I wonder if that isn't that he's pointing us to think about the fact that there's not a career that's simply suitable for him. Because whenever you pursue a career, you know, you've got to pursue advancement. You've got to attend to all kinds of niggly details. You've got to put all your efforts in the service of some goal that you're trying to reach for some practical result. And the great-souled man, he would he would definitely like to be the person that his country turns to in a crisis and says, here, you know, solve this problem and write laws for us. And he would do it. And then he would go away again to his estate. He's not a professional politician. But that's part of what makes him so idle, is that he doesn't want to have to work his way up and deal with the problems of an unruly Congress and that sort of thing.
I thought we could close by talking about justice. I mean, there's a lot more, obviously, to talk about in your book, but the discussion of justice is, you know, often, you know, regarded as another high point in the discussion of the virtues. There's an oddity to the discussion that you point out, which is that the discussion of justice discusses the kind of the nature of justice, but not the motivation for it. That there's the stuff about the noble that we've been talking about. There's very little of that discussion of the noble and what motivates individuals to that. So I guess, I mean, the first just general question is why this abstraction from the noble? Why is this just a general discussion about justice? Secondly, is maybe you could bring out some of these tensions in justice that you identify so well, say between the sort of impartiality of justice, the selflessness of it, versus the, you know, the need to have it and kind of a passion for it, which is very much self-oriented.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the, well, I think on the question of why the noble isn't here more, he's allowed the problems of the noble, the promise and the problems of the noble, to run their course in the earlier virtues, coming to a peak in greatness of soul, and allowing us to see pursuing the noble just for itself lacks content. So now let's turn to justice and think about that, as you say, is a life devoted to justice, a life devoted at the highest to lawgiving. Might that be a better focus for a good life? You would have to come down off the heights a little bit of where the great man of greatness of soul wants to be, but isn't that more constructive? And I think it definitely is. Justice has, what makes justice difficult, and therefore one of the things that makes it high, is that it's very much about fairness. It's very much about not taking too much of the good things. And so it seems to run counter to our most fundamental motivation of wanting happiness. And so we have justice as fairness, as something that the political community needs, but the motivation for each of us to be devoted to that is, it's not really explored here. I think it's explored more in the later books on friendship, where he talks about civic friendship. If there is a motivation to care about justice as fairness, it's a love of the whole country. And then we have the second meaning of justice as comprehensive justice, or the law at its best. What is the law at its best aiming at? Well, it's the whole common good and the thriving of all the individuals. One of the things that Aristotle is showing in this book is that for the most part, every real political community, when it talks and thinks about justice, is thinking much more about fairness and much less about the complete good of all the individuals. That's beyond our reach for the most part. We can do something towards it, but political communities are doing very well if they can just establish a kind of basic fairness. But then fairness has all these parts, and there's solid good meaning to each of them, but they pull against each other. Is it equality? Is it equality then on the basis of everyone getting something similar because they're all citizens, or is it giving more to those who are best, or is it demanding more from those who are best? And again, we tend to think all of the above and not want to have to be too precise about it. And then another really important meaning of justice is corrective or retributive justice. Aristotle brings out the importance of that. He says people tend to feel like they're slaves if they're living in a situation in which they can't get back at those who have hurt them, but he brings out the irrationality of imagining that you are taking away the gain and restoring equality when you're hurting somebody who's done something wrong and who's acted on the basis of a bad character and has made their own character worse in the process of that. And then the chapter on justice comes to a peak in this wonderful book 5, chapter 7, discussion of natural right or natural justice, which Aristotle says is always changeable, but it's there. It can always be found. And I think the thought is, you can't specify rules that will always be just. You have to balance multiple concerns which pull in different directions. For example, security and honoring what's best. Security, the lower needs of the body and the higher needs of the soul. And so statesmanship is a matter of understanding well what's good about each of the multiple ends that we care about and that the city has to attend to. And knowing when an emergency is so bad, when a crisis is so bad that it's worth bending what would otherwise be, you would otherwise think are universally valid rules. And then another meaning of natural right seems to come down to to having the right regime, but that's complicated too. There's not simply one right regime, but the best regime is the best regime that is possible for a given people. So the thought is there's always a right thing to do, even if there are no universally valid rules. There's always a best regime which is attainable for you, and there's something wonderfully practical and realistic at the same time as being high-minded in that.
This discussion about the natural right or natural justice, I also find it slightly confusing because, I mean, it's a helpful place to look in particular for your thesis or your discussion about the role of reason in the virtues. Because here's a way in which right reason, correct reason kind of comes back in and sets a standard, right? A standard of natural right. But I guess I'm a little confused as to why there would be, you know, a right answer given the multiplicity of different considerations, you know, and inclinations of human beings at any one particular point in time. I mean, couldn't there be a kind of incommensurably different good options that a statesman could face, right? Like you could, you know, do this or do that, which would X and Y would both satisfy different human needs, but it would be hard to, like, you know, measure those human needs according to one standard or yardstick. Right. So, yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, you've introduced kind of great ways in which, you know, there's sort of incommensurably different goods in the moral, the phenomenology of moral life. But as that makes it for me difficult to see, you know, this sort of discussion of natural justice, where we could find a kind of natural justice then.
Right. Good. Okay. So if I could make this very hard question just a tiny bit easier by bringing it back for a moment to the individual. Within our individual lives, there are different goods. There are different things that we care about, different ends. I would say they're different in kind, but they're not incommensurable. And they're not incommensurable for the simple reason that we are each a single being with a single set of concerns in such a way that we can say at each moment, this is what matters most to me. This matters more than that. We don't, in fact, find ourselves just thinking, this is good for my body and this is good for my soul and who knows what I should do. We're able to weigh them, but it comes back to what we truly care about. And I think that's the missing answer that the Nicomachean Ethics keeps pointing us towards. Reason can give us guidance if and only if it can look to what our deepest concerns are. In terms of happiness, not just our own happiness, but the happiness of ourselves and all those that we care about in proportion to the depths of that concern. And a healthy person will have concerns for his family and his friends and his fellow citizens. So that's not looking to the noble itself for its own sake, but it's looking to our deepest nature and our deepest concerns. For a statesman, a wise statesman, who understands well what human thriving is and the possibilities of his people and the needs of his people, it's possible to weigh those things. You can't give a formula for it, but you can see it in action in the greatest statesman. And it involves appealing to the better angels of our fellow citizens' natures and reminding them of what they find meaningful and deeply satisfying in their lives, which is not what they tend to give the most time to, but they should give more of it, and nudging them in that direction and listening to the things that they care about so passionately that they simply have to be responded to and met, which includes anger at those who harm them, but also higher things, and weighing those things as you go. And there's this nice hope that Aristotle is holding out. It's possible to do it. I can't tell you in advance what it's going to look like, but the great historians and the great statesmen give you examples of it.
Well, that's a great, inspiring place to close. I wish we didn't, because there's so many other rich discussions in here, but I'm sure we could go on for hours. So, let me say, Lorraine Pengel, thank you once again for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much for having me and for letting me talk about this wonderful book, Winnicombe-Keene Ethics.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.